Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is the legendary Valerie Condos Field, or Miss Val, as she's affectionately known. Valerie is a longtime head coach of the UCLA women's gymnastics team with seven NCAA championships. She's been named the Pac-12 Coach of the Century. She's a member of the UCLA Athletic Hall of Fame. And most importantly, she has a unique coaching style with a focus on joy, gratitude, and choices. As you'll hear, a relatively recent breast cancer diagnosis in her life has led her to be, quote, anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. Just being around Miss Val, you immediately feel this genuine, positive energy, and I loved getting the chance to meet her and talk with her. So I hope you enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
So you did what is that podcast called? Something of Mastery.
Finding Mastery.
Finding Mastery. Have you done a lot of other podcasts?
No. I've done interviews, TV interviews. Not a lot of podcasts.
I feel like a podcast could be a project that you could take on.
No, I've been told that a lot. And I actually just interviewed Kathy Rigby. Do you know that name? She was a gymnast in the 60s. She was the first American gymnast to ever medal for us at a world championships. She did Peter Pan on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Little Kathy Rigby. She just did Peter Pan at 60 years old. And then I just interviewed two of Marta and Bella Caroli's athletes, Kim Zemeskal and Biddy Aquino, yesterday. And people keep saying to me, what are you going to do with these interviews? I'm like, I have no idea. I was just compelled to interview them because everybody's through all this gymnastics muck. It's just Allie Raisman and Jordan Weaver. So
anyway, what was that like?
What?
Interviewing them.
Oh, them? It was really, really interesting because neither one of them have agreed to be interviewed prior to this because they didn't have an abusive relationship being coached by Bella and Marta. And so if they come out and say that...
And those are the people that worked at the ranch.
They were, right. It's their ranch. The heads of the national team.
Yeah.
So they just basically said that with all of the hurt that's out there, if they came out in support of Bella and Marta as their coaches back in the 80s, that they felt that they would be dismissing the pain that all of these other athletes are feeling. And so they feel like they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
And so because I know them so well and they knew that I wasn't going to be directing all of this to being a witch hunt for the Carolis. And also I told them I won't post anything without your approval. So they agreed to do it.
Wow. Did you know them well?
The girls?
Yeah.
Yeah. Kim, Biddy Aquino did a show that I did at SeaWorld 20 years ago. And Kim Zemeskal, I've known since then because we've recruited all of her athletes from her gym in Texas.
Wait, did you choreograph a show at SeaWorld?
Honey, I have choreographed their summer night shows, which are Cirque du Soleil type of shows. I've been doing this for 28 years. I have an IAPA, which is the biggest award that you can win for a theme park, international theme park.
What?
And I can't tell you how many people have said to me, oh, so you're the one that teaches Shamu how to flip. I'm like, no, I don't teach killer whales how to flip. Yeah, I've done that. That's what I'm doing. I'm leaving Friday for 6 weeks to go down there.
To go do that in San Diego?
Yeah, and Pang, you know Pang,
yes.
My athlete?
Yes.
So I'm directing a brand new show, singing, dancing, hip-hop dancers, whatever, rapping, and she's headlining it.
At SeaWorld,
at night. They're night shows. They're human shows, not their animal shows.
I'm honestly, as you're saying this, I'm picturing a mix of like dance floor action and then like animals.
Whales or animals.
Simultaneously.
No.
Gotcha. That's so cool.
It's so much
fun. A lot, I'm sure.
It's a lot, but it gets me back to my roots.
Of dancing.
Of dance, yeah.
Yeah. So did you just do ballet or did you do a lot of different?
I was only ballet. No, I grew up in the 60s, 70s. In those era, you chose one. You didn't do all. Like, dancers today have to be proficient in all styles of dance. When I was growing up, it was like you were a jazz dancer, or you were a modern dancer, or you were a ballet dancer.
What made you pick ballet?
I had scoliosis. I have scoliosis. My parents put me, the doctor said, put her in ballet.
Really? Mm-hmm. That was, is that still something that they say to do?
Well, I think it would be good if I had a child or someone that had scoliosis, because you want to strengthen all the muscles around your spine to be able to support the curvature of your spine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was good.
Huh.
I hated it because I'm not a born ballet dancer.
Meaning what?
I'm not flexible. I can't tell you how many times I was told, your head is too big, your neck is too short, your feet are too small, you have no turnout, and you've got like these Mamba Greek thighs.
Fun.
But I can dance. So that's how I got through it till I was 22 years old and decided to quit.
Gotcha. What were you like? I'm curious, what were you like as a ballet dancer? I mean, did you get really hard on yourself if things didn't go well? Did
No.
you get nervous before performances?
No. And I attribute that to my mom. My mom loved life. And I was never brought up with a fear of failure. And this is something that I write about in my book, that I don't believe that that word exists. The F word doesn't exist. It's just a word that somebody has made up to make people feel bad. Because anytime you set a goal and you don't achieve the goal, at least you can look back and say what you learned from that. So if you've learned something, how can that be failure? So my mom just taught my brother and I just to do our best and to enjoy what we're doing and to love it. And so if they cast a ballet and I didn't get the lead, then I could look to my friend and go, whoa, that's going to be so much fun for you. You're going to do that, and then I'm going to do this. And, you know, it was never – I was never competitive like that. I didn't realize I was competitive until I got the head coaching job at UCLA.
Really?
Then it kicked in. Mm-hmm. And I was – how old was I? 30. Yeah.
Wow. So now you would describe yourself as competitive, but when you were younger, you wouldn't have. That's interesting.
I don't – I would not describe myself as competitive, but I – do get competitive. So like when I'm, my first thought when I'm coaching our student athletes isn't, we got to win.
Yeah.
My first thought is, wow, how can I help this young woman become the best her that she can be? And if I do that, we're going to be successful on the competition floor.
Yeah. But when it gets down to the wire, like say this year you're at the national championship and you're, you know, you're close, but it's not there yet, then it kind of kicks in, I'm guessing, competitiveness, like, all right, let's do this.
It does, kind of. but we're also in a sport that there's not a lot of strategy that you've got to do on spot. So there's no offense and defense.
Right.
You just, you know, the strategy comes in during the week and during the course of the year where you're strategizing what routines they should do. So once they're in competition, you can affect their mental game a bit. But it's not like if you see that Oklahoma is ahead of you by a full point that you can make a change in the routines.
Right. Yeah.
So this year, honestly, it was – it's a book. It is a whole – this whole season and what happened in the national championship is a Hollywood movie.
So I was watching – you narrated a video that was kind of like a wrap-up mm-hmm. of the experience in St. Louis. And I was actually kind of chuckling at how you said you didn't even – you weren't very good at math. Mm-hmm. So you didn't – weren't even like – you didn't know how close you were to winning.
No.
And even after you guys won, you were like, I was waiting for a phone call for them to be like, sorry, we messed up the scores.
Right. Because we were in fourth place until Pang went.
Yeah. Which –
no, we had to average – okay, we finished on balance beam, which is like the make or break event in most gymnastic settings because it's so difficult to compete well on that event. If I shouldn't say it's difficult to compete well. It's the event where you've got all this external nervous energy coming at you and you have got to really just drown it out and focus on 4 inches.
Yeah.
So going to that event, I just knew that we were in fourth place. And I literally was thinking to myself, well, we finished fourth last year. Let's try to finish third. Because I didn't think, like, I really am not good at math. I didn't think that we had a shot at winning. And then I come to find out later that at that point, we had less than a 3% chance. My friend who's a math teacher told me this. Halfway through the meet, we had less than a 3% chance of winning. And going into the last event, we had to average a 9.95. So you have six athletes compete, you take five scores, the highest five scores. We had to average a 9.95. So in gymnastics, you go from a 10 to a 9.95 with one little head bobble. I mean, that's the difference. There were 30 other athletes from the other five schools, programs. Not one of them had gotten one 9.95. And we had to average five.
So you're like, all right.
So yes, I was not thinking that we were going to win this thing.
Interesting. Actually, I wrote down something you said about her. She won the Honda Award.
Pang.
Which is like,
it's like the
one of the best things you can get in collegiate sports, right?
Right. For women.
And you said something that kind of stuck out to me. The sport of gymnastics is losing Pang's effervescence in what she does and how she does it. I really believe she does gymnastics in a way that nobody else in the world has ever done it and probably will never do it. What did you mean? I mean, so she's seems to be effervescent, like enthusiastic. Why do you think no one will ever be able to do it like her?
I've never coached an athlete. I've been at UCLA now 35 years, I think. I've never coached an athlete that approaches everything that they do throughout their day with such pure joy. And what you see in her in competition is how she shows up. It's how she wakes up, literally. We train set 7:45 a.m. every day. That's her default, is joy, gratitude, fun. And so when you see her up on the events, she's joyful. She's having fun. It's not, I have to do this. I have to score well. I have to get a 10. I have to. Nothing. In fact, before she did her last performance on beam, I went up to her to give her her cues. And I always tell her, slow your dance down so you can keep your core tight. And she looked at me before I could say anything. And she said, Miss Val, it's my last routine. I'm going to enjoy every moment of it.
Versus, oh no, this is all riding on me.
Right.
Wow.
So that mindset, and I contribute a lot of that to her parents, how she was raised. I asked her the week afterwards, they did go to Disney World, and I said, you know, how's your mom? She just must be ecstatic for you. And she said, I mean, Pang finished last year at Nationals on balance beam, she got a 10. And then her last two routines she's ever going to do, bars and beam, at this Nationals, she got 10s on both. What every athlete, however athlete dreams of going out in their career. And I said, your mom must be so happy for you. And her mom just said, I was just so glad you didn't fall, Christine. It's like, to have that kind of a mom that doesn't put that pressure on, you know, I'm just so glad.
Yeah. I'm sure that's like incredibly helpful.
It is incredibly helpful. And I think that, you know, people are asking me a lot, because I've been so vocal about the situation that we're in with the USA Gymnastics now. And I always get the same question as, you know, how do we move forward and how do we change the culture? And I absolutely believe it needs to start in the home.
Really?
I absolutely believe parents need to encourage effort and intention and talk about that and talk about what success will mean to their son or daughter that day. Even if it's not standing up on first place or winning the game, what does success look like? How is it going to feel? And we've got to get away from you can only feel pride and you can only feel accomplished if you've won.
Hmm. Has that been the experience for you in being involved in the sport of gymnastics overall? That's like up until other people like you speaking out and saying this. Is that the culture of gymnastics?
I think it's in culture of sport. I think that it's a culture, especially in America. Mm-hmm. I think that athletes are our royalty. You know, I think when you look at soccer worldwide, you look at, there are people that die, that are killed if they don't win a soccer game. There have been refs that have, I don't know if they've been murdered, but they've certainly been threatened. I mean, it is of that magnitude. And in this country, you know, how much money, time, effort are parents spending to get their young son or daughter to be their absolute very best with extra strength conditioning coaches and nutritionists. And I'm all for developing the human being to be the best that you can absolutely be. But it does come to at what cost.
Right.
And it was really eye-opening to me when they asked me to be the head coach in 1990. I'd been there for 8 years. And I literally looked at the athletic director and I started chuckling. I said, I don't know the first thing about gymnastics. This is ridiculous.
So you went there. Did you first go to UCLA to go to school?
No, I was dancing with the Washington, D.C. Ballet in 1982. I was a professional ballet dancer. I'd not gone to school. And I heard that UCLA needed a dance coach for their gymnastics team. So I called the head coach. And because like I said, I didn't grow up with a fear of failure, right?
Yeah.
So there, I had no trepidation in calling him. He could say no. I wasn't going to take it personally. And I just told him my credentials, and he said they offered me a full scholarship instead of a salary because they didn't have a salary. It was my dream to go to UCLA to be a student, so I was there as a student assistant coach. I was the dance coach for the gymnastics team from 1982 until 1990.
While you were there as the assistant coach, was that a big learning curve? I mean, just being involved?
It kind of was, but I didn't really coach gymnastics, and I don't really know what I was doing there. I probably didn't do much of anything except choreograph. They asked me to coach balance beam, but I had no idea what I was doing. And I guess I must have done something for the athletic director to offer me the position. And then when I told him I didn't know the first thing about gymnastics, she said, I trust you'll figure it out.
How old are you at this point?
30. And I was like, can I have a little bit more than I trust you'll figure it out? And she says, figure out what you do well and hire people to do everything you don't know, which was basically everything that has to do with gymnastics. Mm-hmm. So I figured out, okay, so getting back to your original question about how much importance we put on winning. Once I was now in charge, I remember having this realization one day that everything about athletics is about being able to say, ha ha, we beat you. It's all about bragging rights. Mm-hmm. From peewee football to the NFL to college, the Olympic Games to World Cup soccer, whenever you're playing athletics, it's about being able to get bragging rights. Like right now, we won the national championship last week. Ha ha, we beat you. Okay. But in order for me to do my job as the head coach well, because I didn't grow up in this world of athletics, ha ha, we beat you didn't resonate with me. So I didn't start becoming successful as a head coach until I figured out how to be true to myself. I don't have that competitive DNA
in
me.
So at first you were kind of like, well, here's how my coaches I've had have acted or.
Right. I just tried to mimic other coaches and we didn't do well and I didn't do well and I wasn't believable as a head coach. And so I was actually going to resign after my second year of head coaching, and I was walking through the student union. And I opened up one of Coach Wooden's books, and it happened to open up to his definition of success. And success is peace of mind, which is a direct result, knowing you've done the best that you're capable of doing. And I kept reading because it's like, here's a coach that had won 10 national championships. He has to talk about winning. Success is winning, right? Being at the top of the platform. And I read it again, and I read it again, and I read it. And I had the biggest aha moment of my life, that success is peace of mind in knowing you've done your best. Success is not being able to say, ha-ha, we beat you. Success is not the corner office. Success isn't monetary. Success isn't living in 90210. Success is simply peace of mind in knowing that you have done your best. So I went back to my office, and I said, okay, well, I've been trying to mimic other people. That hasn't worked. So what do I bring to the table? So as a professional ballet dancer, I know how to work through pain. I know how to set a goal. I know what hard work and discipline is. And most importantly, I know how to prepare myself so well that as I'm standing in the wings, I am calm and confident. Isn't that exactly my goal in coaching these gymnasts? To prepare them mentally, emotionally, and physically so that when they're standing in their wings, which is standing there waiting for the judge to salute them, for them to go up in the event, they are calm and confident. And once I realized that was my goal, I knew I could do this job as well, if not better, than anybody else in the world.
Yeah.
And we did. And we do. And that's how I coach. I coach you to be the best you that you can be. And if that means that you're going to be the national beam champion, great. But that's not the end all. Mm-hmm. The end all is, can you go home every single night, not just the night of the national championship, but every single night, and have some quiet time with yourself and your maker and say, I did a good job today.
Is that typically something that when you get an athlete as a freshman, it takes a while for them to actually live out?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that they even get it until they're much older, out of school. I think that in college, you're so young mentally and emotionally. We all know the frontal lobe is not developed until you're 25 years old.
Yeah.
So in college, you're trying to figure so much out and so much is unclear.
And I'm just thinking of, so I've never been a college athlete, but I'm just thinking of when you are that age, like you said, you maybe don't know your full identity yet. And if you're competing on your team, chances are you're very like intensely involved in gymnastics and have been for a while. So maybe previous coaches and training don't necessarily have the philosophy that you seem to have as far as like, mm-hmm. just do your best. Maybe previously they're entering and meeting you with the mentality of, I need to win.
Mm-hmm. You know? I think a lot of coaches coach from the perspective of, how am I going to win? And I believe that the only reason why we do athletics is to develop really, really important life skills. Because it's got to be more than haha, we beat you. So I believe that the military and athletics are the two best venues in which to learn really hardcore life lessons. So my job in helping to develop these young women to become the best that they can be, my job isn't to dictate how they should act. My job is to motivate change. I think coaching is about motivating change.
Is that hard to do?
It's hard. It's not hard. It's more time consuming than simply coaching from X's and O's. I think all great coaches, you have to be a good strategist. You have to know the game. You have to come up with a really good game plan. And you have to have the plan of how to execute the plan and work the plan. But in order to be a great coach, I feel that you've got to have a comprehensive motivation to help this young man or woman, boy or girl, develop all of themselves, not just their technical talent. And so I coach the person before the athlete. And if I coach the person, then when she goes and does the leg lifts for her conditioning, if I'm talking to her about integrity in everything you do, and if I'm talking to her about effort, and I'm talking about intention, and I'm talking about all of this, every single leg lift she does will be that much more intense with her intention to make it as close to excellent as possible versus go do 10 leg lifts.
Right, and then it's...
What's the intention behind the leg lift?
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you recruit that way too? I mean, when you're talking to younger gymnasts, are you recruiting? Are you trying to get to know their personalities, I'm assuming, then before?
Yes, and I'm trying to get them to understand that what being a part of our program is all about. And, you know, we do talk about winning. We do. You set the goal to win a national championship. Now how are we going to get to that goal? But I also tell them that the big picture when you come to our program is learning life lessons. And the biggest lesson I want them to learn is that every single thing they do in life is a choice, and it starts with what they think and what they choose to think. And a lot of young adults don't want to embrace the fact that they have a choice of what they think. Because when you take that responsibility of your thoughts, you can no longer be a victim in life. And that's scary.
Yeah. Actually, that leads me to when you were diagnosed with breast cancer. Because from when I've heard you talk about this, that's what you did.
Right. Yes. When I was diagnosed, I got the call and then I hung up the phone and then I was in my car and I heard very, very, very clearly, be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. And I, whether you translate that to mean it, like cosmic energy or the universe or God or whatever, I believe in our creator and God. And I literally got really snarky in my car. And I said, God, I just got diagnosed with breast cancer. This be anxious for nothing bit that you just told me is not sitting well. And I heard it one more time, very clearly. And I went home and I told my husband the not so great news that I have breast cancer. I said, but get this, I heard be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. And very nonchalantly, he says, yeah, that's from the Bible. Well, I'd never read the Bible. So I went over and got opened the Bible. And he goes, look it up. And sure enough, it's right there, black and white, be anxious for nothing, Philippians 4. And at that moment, my world stopped because this was a commandment. And just like anything in life, it was a choice. I could choose to obey, even though I didn't know how I was supposed to not be anxious. Or I could choose to use the fact that I was diagnosed with breast cancer as my excuse to not be anxious. So I went to the doctor the next day, my oncologist, and she was literally beaming with happiness because she said, you've gone from having the worst type of breast cancer to the best type. Because had you been diagnosed 10 years ago, we had nothing for you. And today, we know the chemotherapy that will work for your specific type of breast cancer. And at that moment, I understood how I was not going to be anxious. By gratitude. Be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. I didn't have to get chemotherapy. If I chose to, I get to get chemotherapy. I didn't have to have a double mastectomy. I got to get a double mastectomy. And that moment changed every moment of my life since then. It's been almost 4 years now. I don't have to go to work. I get to go to work because I have a job to go to. How cool is that?
Yeah. Meaning, how cool is it that research has evolved in the way that I get to do this and
I
just knock it out?
I live in a country that actually has the chemo.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that in countries, even the UK, that can't get chemotherapy because they don't have it. I get to have poison shot through my veins.
Had you been regularly getting mammograms?
Yes.
Out of curiosity? Because I actually, didn't they recently bump up the age that you should start getting them? Like they used to say once you turn 40, and now I actually think it's like maybe 30.
Yes. Breast cancer is very, very prevalent now.
Yeah. You also have been part of a research group mm-hmm. related to this, right? Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about, it was targeted chemo, which I'd never even
right.
heard of.
I hadn't either. It's called the Christine study, and it was the fourth stage of it, so it was the last stage of this study, and when they told me the type of chemo that I was going to get, they said, you know, you can put your name in to be put on this study. And it is for targeted chemotherapy, which means the chemo acts like a smart bomb. And so it doesn't do its thing until it goes through your body and it finds the cancer cell. And then it boom, and it takes out the cancer cell. It doesn't take out everything in its wake. So because of that, you don't get sick. You don't lose your hair. You just, I didn't feel anything.
Really?
And this is hopefully, well, this is the plan, to have targeted chemotherapy available for all types of cancer until we can eradicate cancer. And it was life-changing for me, obviously. I mean, I missed one day of work because I kind of gave myself an out. I was like, I feel a little tired. But that was it.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So did most people in your life even know you were undergoing treatment?
No. I told the student athletes. I told my team. I mean, our staff. I didn't tell my dad because he was 92 at the time. I didn't need to put any more stress on him. I didn't tell the gymnastics community because I didn't want people treating me like I was sick. And so I told them the next year.
After you'd... Mm-hmm.
But it was the whole experience was amazing. Starting with the fact that I got to go in and tell our student athletes that were there what was going on. And I remember one of them looked at my breast. And at that moment, I thought I have an amazing teaching moment right now because my tumor did not feel like a round, small, hard pea like us were told it feels like.
Yeah, which always confuses me because I don't, if it's a round, small pea, how are you going to feel that?
Right. So mine felt like a long pulled muscle. Like in what I felt, I thought it was like 2 inches. It wasn't that long, but that's what it felt like. So as one of my student athletes is looking at my breast, I went, do you want to feel what a malignant tumor feels like? And they kind of were hesitant, but they were like, sure. And at that moment, I'm envisioning HR running into the gym. But them having this learning moment of feeling what a malignant tumor felt like was more important to me than my job. And they did. It was on the side of my breast. They felt it. And it was so great for them to go through this whole thing with me. When I wasn't there and I told them I told them I'm going to my chemo spa. And one of them said, "Why? You don't have to put like this positive spin on it." I said, "It is. I'm not putting a positive spin. It is a spa. You go to a spa to help your body get better. That's where I'm going. I'm going to my chemo spa."
Did you wake up with that mentality every day? Or were there some times where you were like, could feel it creeping in?
Every single moment, every day that I open my eyes, I go, I get another day. And I promise you, I'm going to make this day so great. Every day. Every single, because none of us are guaranteed another day. None of us. Forget cancer. Just none of us. Accidents, earthquakes, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Working at the news. That's a daily reminder.
It is. And that was another big thing with me was that I had this bucket list of things I wanted to do once I retired. But I'm like, there's no guarantee I'm going to get to there, to that age. There's no guarantee I have tomorrow. So let's not waste today.
Yeah.
And I've always been a pretty positive person. But I think... In my life, I allowed myself to have a pity party and I allowed myself to make excuses and getting diagnosed with breast cancer has only made every aspect of my life better. And I know that I'm very, very, very fortunate to say that because I know that there are a lot of people that are diagnosed with cancer that don't have the experience that I had. I know that. But I think it's really important for people to also understand that just because you hear those horrible, horrible, horrible words doesn't mean you've got to go to dark and negative.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying is really helpful for anyone going through that or just a tough time in their life in any way.
Well, and one of my favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And it's a very small book. I know that a lot of students read it in grade school grown up, and it's Viktor Frankl was a prisoner of war and who just wrote about his experience and how every day he found something to be grateful for. And he lived with a mind of gratitude. And when you're constantly living in gratitude, your mind cannot focus then on the negative. And even being in a prisoner of war camp with the atrocities that he lived through and he saw, he chose gratitude. He chose to look out his cell and be grateful that he could actually see a piece of the sky.
Wow.
I know.
It's incredible how powerful your mind is.
Right.
And how it can just change all aspects of your day.
What you choose to think dictates the life that you're going to live. And that's like, I tell every recruit, if you learn one thing in the 4 years you're at UCLA, I want you to memorize this and marinate on it, that life is about choice. And every choice you make is going to have numerous repercussions that will dictate and design the life you live. Every single choice starts with what you choose to think.
Yeah, I'm sure that's incredibly, incredibly beneficial for like an athlete's physical ability too. Like just having what you're saying, that mindset, once you are competing, like the difference between, I'm just thinking of, you know, if you mess up on a routine or fall off, the difference between choosing to keep going versus, ugh, I messed up and
right.
You know,
well,
getting upset.
Well, the most common thing that gymnasts think about when they're up on beam and they're young is don't fall. As soon as you think don't fall, you're going to fall.
Oh, yeah.
So it really is a lesson in acting 101. Act like you're confident. Mm-hmm. Act like you're happy. Act like you're powerful. Act like it. Talk to yourself. Find that mantra. I got this. I got this. Say it over and over and over. Even if you don't believe it, you say it. Because if you say it, then the negative stuff can't be in your mind. Those two things cannot coexist in your mind. So choose mm-hmm. which one you're going to feed. The positive, which will give you an opportunity to have a better result, or the negative. And the negative, when you choose the negative, the only reason you're choosing it because you want an out. You want the excuse. You want to be a victim.
Is that your pregame speech?
No, this isn't even my pregame because they hear it. They've heard it so much. They hear it all the time.
Yeah.
Like if you ask any of them, they're going to say, Ms. Val's going to tell you life is about choice.
Do you give a pregame speech?
I don't do pregame. No.
No.
Mm-mm. Because I feel that the work is done during the week. So pregame, we is all about connectivity within the team and getting them loose. So we'll gotcha. Do like our pregame will be Trivia Pursuit. They're divided up in two teams, blue versus gold. And I love to do Trivia Pursuit as to, especially once we get into season, like how many athletes on our team have scored a 99 or higher? How many athletes on the team have received a perfect 10 this year? How many? But I actually like to structure the questions that celebrate everyone's accomplishments, not just the superstars.
Yeah.
And it's really cool for them to see how much they've grown and really what they've accomplished in those moments. So
yeah, I like that. That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching I feel like a lot of UCLA's floor routines, like the videos always go viral.
They do.
Right?
Well, not always. The last
a lot
years,
of them have.
There's well, yeah, and there's no other teams that have.
Really? That's like kind of specific mm-hmm. to UCLA and your choreography.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And I do have to give a shout out to one of my undergraduate assistant coaches, Hallie Mosette. She was on the team for the last 4 years. She was our undergraduate assistant this year. Her routine went viral last year. She did Beyonce routine. And that went viral. So she's helps me quite extensively with choreography. I don't do hip hop, so she does that. But the reason why the floor routines go viral, 3 years ago it was Sofina De Jesus, and she got 25 million hits. Hallie's went viral with, or views, she's went viral with like 11 million. And then Caitlin's this year, Caitlin Ohashi's 60 million views.
Is that the one with Michael Jackson?
Yes.
So the takeaway that I had from that, because I remember seeing it and I didn't know her name, now I do, but is, so she's doing her routine and you see the other people on the gymnastics team, like in the corner cheering her on. And there's one moment where she's like going, you know, moving her arms and you see them all doing it with her. Mm-hmm. And it just looks like they're having honestly so much fun.
We do. We have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun. I believe in the power of the spirit of dance, and I believe the spirit of dance is in all of us. And I believe that when you release it, you're releasing your inner joy, because people that are not comfortable dancing are uptight.
Yeah.
And I don't believe, I don't care if you're a good dancer or not. It's not about that. It's embracing the spirit of dance that we're, that is in with each of us. And when you embrace it, you are joyful. And isn't that the state of mind you want your athletes to be in when they're competing?
Yeah. And I mean, normally at that level competing, you're nervous, but like watching her, and she's, there's even a moment where she's like shaking her head. Mm-hmm. Like she's just so sassy. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, she's having fun. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, oh, it's,
I had an, I had a coach tell me last year, we finished fourth, and he said, I think that you would do so much better if you didn't have so much fun and just focused more on the gymnastics. And I said, okay. I said, well, who has the most fun? Well, Pang. I'm like, she just got a 10 at the national championships.
Yeah.
Who else has the most fun? Caitlin Ohashi. Okay, she just PR'd. Okay, let's go through the list. The two people that did not do well on our team were the ones that were uptight, not embracing the fun. So the fun, there is a wonderful equation about this. You can't just have fun. Mm-hmm. However, I believe that we do our best learning when we bring joy into it.
Yes.
And I don't understand why any coach would want to take the joy out of learning.
I know. I'm curious why that person would have come up to you and even said that.
Because it's an anomaly. It's like, how can you be a national champion and be having so much fun? Before you go up on beam, you're supposed to be dialed in and focused and all this, you know, and stern and blocking everything out, not having fun.
Right.
But there is the moment for that, and every athlete's different. Caitlin Ohashi needs 2.5 seconds for that switch from fun to focused. Someone like Madison Koshin, an Olympic gold medalist, she needs about 3 minutes before she goes up on beam of the focus. And we do a good job of allowing our athletes to determine what they need. Mm-hmm. And if it's not working for them, we'll help them figure it out. But, you know, for Caitlin, she really is over there dancing, having fun. And then all of a sudden she realizes the judge is saluting her and she'll run up and get up on beam and score 10.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
So without knowing a lot about the sport of gymnastics, would you say that your program stands out in that way?
Yes.
Like when you're at competitions, do the Bruins seem to be like having the most fun?
I don't notice it because I don't watch other teams, but I'm told this, that we are having the most fun. I think that comes from the fact that I am performance based. And so everything that our student athletes do is purposeful. How they wear their hair, how they wear their makeup. I don't let them wear face tattoos, like the school's tattoo on their cheek. I don't believe that makes them look better. Mm. How they act, how they smile, everything is predetermined. And so it's not like I tell them when to smile,
yeah,
but this is the mood that we're going to have going to vault. This is the mood we're going to have going to bars. This is, you know.
Yeah.
These are the drills we're going to do right before we go up to get them into that zone where they can release their brilliance. And the hard work is done during the week, and the competition is time to celebrate that hard work. And the competition, I mean, when you get athletes of this caliber, it's not like they're going to treat it like the playground or recess.
Right. They're there for a reason.
They're going to err on the side of making it too important, which will make them tight. So I think the reason why we won the meet was because none of our athletes knew they had to average a 9.95 to win. And I believe one reason why we won the meet was because I didn't know. Because had I known, I might have overcoached. Because every one of the girls that went up on beam said to me before they went up, I went up to every single one of them to give them their cues that are strong legs or core, tight core. Every one of them I have a cue for. Every single one of them stopped me, looked me in the eye and said, Miss Val, I got this. And I shut up and I backed away. Caitlin Ohashi grabbed my hand and she said, Miss Val, this is where we thrive. And I walked away. Had I known that we need to be near perfect, I might have overcoached. Had I taken myself out of my whole purpose on Beam was to enjoy them one last time. Mm-hmm. Enjoy them.
Do you feel like you ever overcoach?
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen a lot?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. But we work to have a really good communicative open dialogue with our student athletes where they can tell us.
Yeah.
And we'll have meetings where we just go around the table and say, tell me what works and doesn't work for you. To your teammates also, you know, and they feel comfortable enough, and we've developed the culture in our program where, you know, besides life is about choice and that mantra, they all know that the next thing you need to learn is that you can say anything you want to anyone as long as you're being honest and respectful. And if you're not being honest, you're not being respectful because you're saying to that person, I don't trust you can handle the truth. So when we're in these meetings and Madison Koshin might say to Kyla Ross, you know, I know your intention was to help me compete better on vault, but when you come up to me and tell me, go big, that's not what I want to hear. Hmm. I want you to tell me, I trust you, you got this. And so whatever resonates with them, they then share with all of us, and we remember that,
mm-hmm.
as long as it's working.
Yeah.
If they're telling us they only want to hear something, but it's not working in competition, then we'll talk about, you got to change this pregame. Let's talk about something new that you can start focusing on.
Gotcha. So I'd like to just talk about just specifically gymnastics as a sport itself. I feel like you coming in, I've honestly learned just more about gymnastics than I'd known before. Just as far as like, what would you say is kind of the traditional way that most of your athletes have been raised in gymnastics? Is it kind of like a tough approach?
Very tough.
And what is like the window of opportunity for a gymnast? Like what ages?
Because
Olympians will come to you post Olympics.
But look at Kyla Ross. The last time she competed internationally, she was 5'2". She's 5'7".
Yeah, that's nuts.
So when you look at the sport of gymnastics, and I got a D in physics, as I was just going to say, I'm not proud of it, but it's the best I could do. Gymnastics is physics. So just look at them swinging around that bar. If they put on the freshman 10 pounds, how is that going to change the dynamic of their swing on bars? It's going to slow them down. It's going to make them bottom heavy. It's mm-hmm. going to, you know, it's going to start wear and tear on their shoulders, all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So gymnastics is so scientific in that aspect. It's also a very, very tough sport because think about it. You can go play any other sport. You may suck, but you can. You can't play gymnastics.
Right.
You can't get up on the bar and swing around the bar. Freddie Mitchell, who is one of our best all-time wide receivers, football, came in gym one day, says, Miss Val, I want to go around the bar, like a giant around the bar. I'm like, go ahead, Freddie. He had like a 24-pack in his stomach. I'm like, great, go around the bar, Freddie. And he jumped up on the bar, and he just started like swinging. He wasn't going anywhere. He's like, how do they get on the bar? I'm like, because they started when they were like 3. That's how they got around the bar.
Yeah.
So you cannot play the sport. It's also extremely dangerous if you take it lightly. So at a very, very, very young age, they learn to be really disciplined in their focus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why you see younger gymnasts that don't look like they are having the joy that the older gymnasts do, because they're not proficient at knowing how to flip it from being really dialed in and focused to having fun.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't know how to dial in that focus, they will get severely injured.
Gotcha.
So it's, you know, a part of what happens with our national team training camp and all that, and the discipline and the regiment, you never see the kids smile, never see them having fun, nothing. Part of that is because they're doing such hard skills, they cannot relax their focus until they've put in the 10,000 repetitions and the muscle memory has kicked in, and then they can start relaxing, enjoying it.
Gotcha. Do you feel like some athletes, it takes longer than others, though, to learn how to switch to that, what you're describing, to be focused, but then make that switch to having fun as well?
I honestly, yes, because they're all different. Everybody's a different human being. But I also feel the athletes that have the hardest time with it are those that will not stop with the negative talk in their head. And it's either because they feel that they need an excuse, either for their parents or themselves. Quite often it's for their parents. Mm-hmm. Or it's because they're perfectionists and they won't allow anything less than perfection, which is a whole nother discussion we have, that perfection doesn't exist.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems like that probably comes up a lot, perfection.
And it does.
Like just years of intense training and maybe even like weight shaming. I mean, you know,
it's horrible.
Because of what you're describing and mm-hmm.
the body shaming. Yeah. And the body shaming, a lot of the body shaming comes from the fact that when the Eastern European countries blocks, when they broke, a lot of those gymnasts came to America. So a lot of our top coaches in this country are from Eastern European countries, mm-hmm. Russia, Romania, Bulgaria, the Ukraine. And they were brought up with only one way. All they know is this dictatorial, strict way of training and learning. And a big part of that is because in those countries, that's your livelihood. And quite often, those gymnasts were the ones, the breadwinners for their families. That's how important winning was to the Russians and the Romanians and all them. So they come over here, they implement that regime into our American culture, and they're successful. Mm-hmm. As far as winning, they weren't successful as in developing young girls into strong, empowered, confident young women, but we were successful in medals. Mm. And also, because of the language barrier, that's when you would get them saying things like, "You look like a fat pig trying to fly." It's like they didn't know how else to say it because mm-hmm. their English skills were so poor. Mm-hmm. So a lot of negative coaching that, you know, I've been asked so many times about Marta and Bella Caroli because they were just so verbally and emotionally abusive. But I don't believe that was their intention. Their intention was to produce great athletes.
Right.
Their intention wasn't to break them down. Actually, their intention probably was to break down their inner voice because then they could be more malleable, just like in the army, you mm-hmm. know? They want to brainwash you.
And for those who don't know, they were coaches for the national team.
Yes.
In Michigan.
No.
Oh.
No, that's a whole other story. No.
Where's that based?
In the ranch in Houston.
Houston. Got it.
Bella and Marta Caroli ran the ranch in Houston, which became the National Team Training Center. And Marta Caroli has been the national team coordinator for the last 3 Olympic cycles, mm-hmm. I believe, maybe more. And her husband, Bella, was before that.
Gotcha.
And they, the team doctor was Larry Nassar, who was from Michigan.
Gotcha, which is why the trial was in Michigan.
Right.
Makes sense. But the ranch.
Well, he worked at Michigan State.
Right. Actually, if I want to actually quickly talk about just your experience going through all that. I read a post that you wrote about it in January, and it was just before he was sentenced. As a head coach, I mean, I'm assuming that probably rattled the whole gymnastics community. I mean,
it's still rattling.
It was everywhere. I'm not in gymnastics, and it was on the news every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably you're gonna like keep seeing the effects of that mm-hmm. forever. as the head coach of a gymnastics team, and you guys had people there who were involved and who gave an impact victims. Statement, do you address the team as a whole?
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny you ask that. I am the only college coach that's really been very vocal speaking out as an advocate for them.
The only college gymnastics coach?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't know the reason why others haven't taken a more vocal standpoint. I'm not judging at all. I've had it quite a... Okay, so our volunteer coach, Jordan Weber, was a 2012 gold medal Olympian. She was one of the victims that came out and gave a testimony in Michigan against Larry Nassar. And the day after her testimony, we were in Arizona competing against the University of Arizona. And we couldn't, nor did I want to pretend like this just didn't happen. Like Jordan right. was, you know, out at Disneyland or something.
Right.
And so I felt it was my duty to discuss this with our student athletes and to help them put words to this really dark, horrible thing that is now being uncovered that a lot of them experienced as well. And so we talked about it. Jordan came back. We all decided to wear teal ribbons because teal is the color to support victims of sexual abuse.
You guys had a meet called Together We Rise or...
Right. And so with Oklahoma, Oklahoma's top gymnast, Maggie Nichols, she was known prior to this as Athlete A, the first athlete that came out and told the United States Gymnastics Federation about Larry Nassar in 2015. And she decided to come and put a name to Athlete A this last year. So we were competing against Oklahoma that next weekend. And so I looked at this as a tremendous opportunity to take a really horrible, horrible thing that's happened in our sport and start empowering our athletes to have a voice, to stand taller, and to feel that they are no, even though they were victimized, they are not victims. They are survivors. They are strong. They are empowered. They are thriving because they have identified what happened to them. They've put words to it, and they've chosen to move on and not let Larry Nassar dictate their lives anymore. And so talked to the Oklahoma head coach. She was all in. We both got white T-shirts. We both put Together We Rise in teal. And at the end of the meet, our videographer had produced a video. She'd gotten testimony from athletes from Oklahoma and from our athletes. And we had three of the previous gymnasts that are now in their 30s that have been on 60 Minutes that came out about this. They were my alumni. UCLA's alumni.
Yours.
My. And so we honored them. We honored Jordan. We honored Maggie from Oklahoma. And then at the end of this, both teams came onto the floor as unified in their white T-shirts with Together We Rise. And it was... I've had people just tell me it was the most important gymnastics meet that's ever happened, the unification of these young women.
Yeah, I mean, knowing what's going on around that time, imagine if you hadn't have done that. Like, how would these... Like, that's so incredible that they had that opportunity to... Because isn't...
But the important part of that is that I did have other coaches of other universities call me and say, we don't want to wear the teal ribbons because we have athletes on our team that are victims and they haven't come forward yet. And my whole thing was, I am not trying to shame anyone into this. This is what we chose to do. And as a victim of anything in life, we all know you should never feel pressured to make a statement or to come out or to come forward until you are ready. It's your story to tell when you are ready. I wasn't trying to make everybody feel we had to wear teal ribbons in our hair. Mm-hmm. That's what we chose to do. And I have had athletes on my team say when we started talking about it, they did not want to talk about it. But because we gave them a safe space in which to talk and trust that what we talked about would not be shared on social media and everything, it made them feel better about themselves. And I feel one reason why we had such a stellar season this year is because our athletes felt empowered. They walked taller. They had a purpose. They weren't hiding anything anymore. They were released.
Wow.
I know.
I'm just like, when you were describing the meet and everyone being together afterwards, because isn't Oklahoma pretty good? They're gymnastics.
No, they were the reigning national champs. They should have won this year.
Yeah, so
they won the last two championships.
Are they? I mean, I would think, are they? Do you guys, I mean, traditionally view them as a force to be reckoned with?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. So it's cool that.
Absolutely.
You guys were able to do that.
Absolutely. They are a brilliant, brilliant program.
Wow.
With amazing athletes and coaches. We have a tremendous amount of respect for them.
I feel like you're the best coach to have. I mean, I just wish that I was like, could call you in the morning
you
when I'm
call
feeling
me,
down.
Honey, anytime you want, as long as you say, oh my gosh, Miss Mel, we got another day. Let's make it amazing.
That's what I mean. I need that sometimes. Who gave you, is there one person who started calling you Miss Val?
Yes. 1982. One of the first things that they asked me to do with the gymnastics team was give them a ballet class. And so in ballet, you grew up calling your teacher Miss So-and-so. So one of the little smart Alex, her name is Lisa Taylor, and she was awesome, but she's kind of smart Alec. He said, are we supposed to call you Miss Val? I said, sure, call me Miss Val. I don't care. And it just kind of stuck.
Do you like it?
I like it because I feel when people call me Miss Val, I feel like there's a bit of respect that comes with it. I don't like it because it kind of makes me sound prissy. But I'm not Val. Most people don't call me Miss Val, call me Val, but my family's never called me Val. I'm Valerie.
Or in
the gymnastics world, I'm Miss Val.
Right.
But people that, you know, think that we're cool and hip and all that call me Val and whatever. I really don't care. Just don't call me ma'am. I really don't care what I'm called. But when they call me coach, I still giggle because I don't feel like a coach.
Really?
I've never felt like a coach. I remember getting inducted into the UCLA Athletic Hall of Fame, and I got the letter. And I sat down, and I said out loud, I'm like, maybe I am a coach.
I mean, did we actually win the national title, or are they going to call me and tell me we didn't
right.
win?
It's just like the Academy Awards. They opened the wrong envelope.
Oh,
they're going to tell me. Yeah.
So one thing that I definitely wanted to ask you, this was your seventh national title that you guys won this year.
Mm-hmm.
Does it get sweeter every time? Does mm-hmm. it ever feel like, does each time get better?
Because mm-hmm. it's really, 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 really hard to win a championship. It's ridiculously hard.
Yeah. And I imagine as the years go on, programs are getting better. There's
right. And every team is different.
Yeah.
Every dynamic is different. Everything is different.
Yeah.
And if you try to do same old, you will not be successful. You've got to keep reinventing yourself constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have won a championship in the last three decades is absolutely remarkable because it's so stinking hard.
Yeah.
And it's hard as a coach to keep yourself fresh, but not try to mimic other people. And I remember one of my most favorite interviews was 2004, after we'd won our fourth championship in 5 years. And the LA Times did an interview with me and Coach Wooden.
Together?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And we were really good friends. And they said to me, you're becoming the next John Wooden. And before, I mean, that was like blasphemy. And before I could say, no, I'm a disciple. I'm not, you know. Before I could say anything, Coach Wooden kind of chuckled and he said, why would she want to be another John Wooden when she can be a great Valerie Kondos Field?
That's why people like him.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Aw.
Yeah. Yeah, he was remarkable.
Did he give you any advice about coaching that you
Coach Wooden never gave anybody advice, ever.
Really?
Even when you asked him. The day 9/11 hit, it was going to be the very, very first day of our team reported back. And So I was planning my whole report back speech, right? Yeah. And 9/11 hits as I'm getting in my car to go to the office, and I've got nothing. And I called Coach Wooden, and I said, okay, we are just living through the worst thing in the history of America. Everything that I planned to say to our student athletes is now out the window. What do I say to them? And he said, oh, honey, just follow your heart. You'll know what to say. I was like, no, 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 Coach. I got nothing. I need something.
Nothing's coming from my heart.
Nothing is coming. My heart is numb right now. I need, just give me a little nugget. And he said, honey, just follow your heart. Anything I tell you will not be authentic. So it's got to come from you. And I walked in that room and we talked about it. And one of the student athletes said, Miss Val, I don't think I can ever do gymnastics again because this is so important, what happened right now to our country. Playing sports is so minimal to what happened. I need to go figure out how to leave a strong footprint. And why would we ever do gymnastics again? And it was so clear to me. Because we can. Because we live in a country where as young women, you can play sports. You're not having to wear a burqa and all of that.
Yeah, you can show your legs.
You can show your legs. You can be clad in a skin-tight leotard and play sports as a woman. The reason why we're going to go in there is because we can. And I guarantee you that every time you do gymnastics now, you're going to be doing it with a better intention and purpose, out of appreciation and gratitude. Because I can. And at that moment, I realized how brilliant Coach Wooden was.
He was right.
He was right. Yeah. So I have to share with you that the title of my book is Life is Short, Don't Wait to Dance. And it basically stands for we're not guaranteed tomorrow, right? So live today in the spirit of dance and release yourself. It's also an homage to Coach Wooden, because anybody that asked him later on in his life if he had any regrets, because he lived a very, very, very devout life. He was an amazingly devout human being. And he would always say he had one regret, that his wife Nellie loved to dance. And he wasn't a good dancer, and he was very shy. And so he never danced with his wife.
He regretted that. That's so cute.
So if he had one thing to do over, he would dance with his wife. Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, that is. That's really sweet.
Yeah.
So you wrote a book.
I did. I have.
Is it out?
Daunting. No, it comes out next October.
Yeah. What's that experience like?
Daunting. Horrific. You know in college when you have to write that 20-page paper and you get to about page 15 and you just want to stop? You don't care anymore. You're done.
And instead of like 12-point font, you make it 12.5 font and hope the professor doesn't notice.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what writing a book is like.
Oof. So you finished it though?
I finished it. The publisher has it. They are restructuring it. I've now got to write this last chapter of what happened at the national championship, because Pang is already in my book. Caitlin's already in the book. And so we've got to write that. The whole book is simply about how does a dancer choreographer become one of the winningest athletic coaches in history. And a lot of what I do is so unorthodox compared to what traditional coaches do. Mm-hmm. Like our pregame and all of that, or what I talk to them about. We never talk about gymnastics, really. We talk about life. How I talk to our student athletes that the balance beam is a stage. It's 4 inches wide and it's 16 feet long. And it's a stage and you better perform. That's why every one of our athletes smiles on the balance beam, because it's a stage and it's a performance. And that's not normal. And so I have a co-author, and I was telling him, I was getting cold feet a few months ago, and I just think we need to scrap this, because people are going to read this and they're going to think they're going to get all these nuggets of wisdom from this championship coach, and I'm going to come off cross as a total whack job. And he goes, no, that's exactly why you have to write the book, because you are a whack job, but you're successful at it. And you're gonna empower other whack jobs to do them and then be successful at whatever they want to do. And I was like,
oh, yeah.
Okay, let's write the book.
I love that. I just love it because don't you feel like in life you do things and you're like, are people going to catch on that I actually don't know what I'm doing?
Right.
You know?
Right. Imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. There's also Michael Gervais coined a phrase called FOPO, fear of other people's opinions.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
And we all have mm-hmm. FOPO. We all prevent ourselves from doing what we want to do. Like that, like go back to being a child. You don't have FOPO.
Yeah. You just, you put a concert on in your garage because you're a pop star.
Right.
In your head.
Right.
Yeah.
How much fun would your life be if you did not succumb to FOPO?
I know. Seriously.
That's a daily struggle for all of us. Mm-hmm. But our lives, I mean, my life is in, when I do not care about what somebody else thinks, my life blossoms in living color. My days, every moment of my day is so spectacular, not worrying about what someone else is going to think.
How did you say the acronym?
FOPO, fear of other people's opinions.
FOPO.
FOPO. It's not FOMO, it's not fear of missing out.
It's FOPO.
It's fear of other people's opinions.
Yeah, I would say people have that a lot more than FOMO. FOMO is out there for sure. But FOPO.
I think that almost every single person that posts something, they're going through fear of other people's opinions before they hit send, mm-hmm. before they hit post.
Oh, yeah.
How is this going to be perceived? And I know that I have it because I can't stand the fact that I have to be on social media. I don't enjoy it. I don't care, mm-hmm. really. I use it kind of like as my news stream. That's about it. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care to see another selfie as long as I live. People get real, right? But when you're writing a book and you're doing speaking engagements and you're putting yourself out there, that is your marketing. You don't yeah. hire a marketing people anymore. That's how you market yourself. That's how you develop your brand. So every single thing I post, I'm going through fear of other people's opinions. Mm-hmm. What are they going to think about this? And am I going to be conveyed how I want to be conveyed?
Yeah. I imagine that's like also going through the heads of your athletes too, because a lot of the gymnastics athletes that you coach are almost like influencers themselves. Like I feel like
Absolutely.
They have
most
a
of them
lot
have,
of people.
Yeah. Most of them have, I don't know, 20 to 30, 40,000 followers. The Olympians have in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And they are influencers.
Yeah.
They absolutely, and we talk about that a lot. That's one thing that I think Pang, her just being herself and living as she lives every moment, she is constantly strengthening her brand with her enthusiasm for life and her gratitude for life and her joy for life. Her brand is so strong because you can scroll through all of her social media. You will not find one slutty photo. You won't find one post that she's using in proper word.
Yeah, and I mean, how old is she? 23, 24?
She's old. She's going to be 25. It's her sixth year.
Oh, she's sixth year?
She's
wow.
sixth year. So and I've known her since she was 10.
Oh.
And so now, one of the shows that I'm choreographing at SeaWorld, she's the headliner for. So, and it's really cute because her followers call themselves the Penguins.
No.
So she went down to SeaWorld when she had the audition. She goes, "Miss Val, I have to go take some photos with my people." So she went and found the Penguins and she took photos with them.
That's hilarious.
Isn't that a riot?
I love how fan groups make names for themselves.
Yes.
The Beehive, the Penguins, right. the Swifties. I
right.
love it.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for coming in here. I was really excited about it and I'm even more excited because I feel like you're just a great person to talk to. Like you, if you had a color of energy, it would be like yellow maybe.
Thank you.
You know, I don't know if that sounds
like... You're so cool. I told my husband this years ago. I was trying to explain to him what I was feeling and we were arguing about something and I was like, you don't understand. I live every day in living color, and sometimes it's jewel tones, and sometimes it's pastels, and sometimes it's earth tones, but they're rich, vibrant colors. And he looked at me like I was crazy. But what you just said, I get it. And that is such a compliment.
Good.
To live in yellow.
I mean it.
Thank you.
Don't you think? You know how when you see people and you're like, yes. Oh, hold on.
And I told him, I said, Bobby, you live your life in cobalt blue. And he took it as an insult because it was blue, right? No. You're a rich, deep cobalt blue. But for the most of the time, you're blue. It's just blue.
Yeah.
Where I've got all these pops of all this sparkles coming out.
Right. Yeah. Well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very
thank
much.
You for doing your podcast. They're exciting. They're fun. They're interesting. And it's great to hear from people that are just out there killing it in life.
Thank you.
Olympic and Bundy.
No FOPO. Thanks for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you haven't already, check out episode 28 with one of her former athletes, the now Hollywood stuntwoman, Heidi Moneymaker. Subscribe to the Olympic and Bundy podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher to get new episodes automatically downloaded to your phone. And if you enjoyed the episode, leave us a rating and review of what you liked. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thank you again for listening.